everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We did not call the people to confront the people. We called on the people to defend their revolution.
Cuba's president tells loyalists to fight back and blames the country's unrest on the U.S. We look at the challenges facing the region with former Mexican Foreign Minister Jorge Castañeda. Then, Hungary under fire for a new law many call homophobic. I'll talk about this and more with Foreign Minister Peter Sciarto. And violence in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal. We get the story of a chilling massacre of Afghan commandos. Plus, as many start to get a taste of freedom, should we be worried about how much we're drinking? We'll find out.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour, who will be back next week. President Biden has his hands full in the Caribbean, that is for sure. First with the assassination of Haiti's president, and now with the unrest in Cuba. The country's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, is blaming rare anti-government protests on U.S. policies. In a national address that lasted over 4 hours, he called on loyalists to defend the revolution. Anti-government activists claim more than 100 people have been arrested following widespread protests on Sunday. Thousands took to the streets amid a crushing economic crisis made worse by the pandemic and U.S. sanctions. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says placing the blame on America's shoulders is wrong.
I think it would be a grievous mistake for the Cuban regime to interpret what is happening in dozens of towns and cities across the island as the result or product of anything the United States has done. It would be a grievous mistake because it would show that they simply are not hearing the voices and will of the Cuban people.
Let's go live to the capital of Havana, where CNN's Patrick Opman has the latest. And Patrick, you have been there on the ground since the beginning of these rare anti-government protests, the likes we haven't seen in decades. Now, a few days in, as you have reported, that thousands have even tried to flee on makeshift rafts and boats. What are you seeing today? Are these protests continuing at the same rate?
No, they're not being allowed to, and that's because of several different things. The Cuban government, which was caught unawares by this wave of protests, not just in Havana, but in cities across this island, even in some small towns where everyone knows everyone, and the people had the courage just felt they had nothing left to lose to go out into the streets, even though everyone knows who they are. And say that they wanted change. So now there are police throughout certainly Havana, and they are keeping a very close eye on things. We are hearing about mass arrests. Remember, the president of Cuba said that all the protesters, thousands of them, were criminals, essentially, that they had broken and stolen things, broken into stores. So there has been no attempt here to mend this open wound and perhaps try to calm down the situation. The president of Cuba as well, initially, you remember, said that he was giving an order of combat for supporters of the revolution to go out and retake the streets. And that's what we are seeing throughout Cuba, groups of pro-government supporters assisted with police going out and letting people know that the protests will not be tolerated anymore. On top of that, there is an internet blackout across Cuba right now. It makes it very, very hard to gather information, to report, to know what's going on across the island. And we are not seeing what we saw all day on Sunday, really incredible images of people by the thousands going out and protesting. People are just unable right now to upload those images. And of course, those were one of the main sparks for these widespread protests.
Yeah, let me ask you more about the internet outages there and the role of social media, because as in all of these protests that we've seen throughout history, context is important. And the one thing that we haven't seen in comparison to, let's say, the 90s or even the revolution itself, obviously, was the internet and the role of social media. How significant significant has that been over these past 4 days? And given that, there are so many outages now, is the government's control and clampdown working?
Well, I remember when I first moved here 9 years ago, and when I left our office, I was offline. And it was only about 3 years ago that Cubans got internet on their cell phones, and that has been a game changer. And we've seen people sharing images and information that perhaps annoy the government. But this is very, very different. The government sees this as an existential threat, and they are blocking now, according to companies that follow this, internet usage, blocking Cubans' ability to get online, to access social media, to post, to share videos, because they've seen now that this new technology for Cubans is being used to thwart and subvert the government. And that is perhaps why the Cuban government always was so reluctant over the years to give people this kind of access, and did so grudgingly, because they realized it was holding Cuba back and there was really no excuse. But again, this is something very new for Cubans, that they had this ability to share their daily existence with the outside world. But on Sunday, when the government saw how people were using this technology, and the government controls all communications on this island, the only communications companies are state controlled, and they have pulled the plug and pulled it quite hard. And for much of this island, it is people are just in the dark.
Yeah, and it is interesting that it was Raul Castro over the last few years who was sort of eased up incrementally on some of these restrictions like internet access. And speaking of Raul Castro, who stepped down last year, we know that he actually participated in high-level government meetings today. What should we be reading into that, if anything?
There's so much to read into that, because if Raul Castro stepped down from his last leadership post in April, he said he was retiring, that he could have stayed on in some capacity, but he felt that was not needed. He turned over his titles of president and head of the Communist Party to his handpicked successor, Miguel Díaz-Canel. And so the fact that Raul Castro, we haven't seen images of this meeting, but took part in this meeting, this emergency meeting about the protests, really speaks a lot. It's certainly trying to perhaps comfort the nerves of some people who are government supporters, who are a little concerned that just within months of Raul Castro stepping down, that we had this kind of widespread chaos, really. That's what it was on Sunday. And certainly Raul Castro is letting people know that he is very involved in the decisions that are being made. You can certainly see how the government is not accepting any kind of criticism, any kind of protest. A very different scene from Sunday, right, where for the first time ever, I saw people yelling anti-government slogans into the faces of police. But there were so many people doing it that the police simply could not do anything about it, at least not then. Now they are hearing about people who were involved in the protest being arrested, and as well people just who were in the wrong place at the wrong time being arrested. And while opposition activists say that they believe over 100 people have been arrested, they have 100 names, they say the number is probably quite a bit higher.
Right. Arrested or missing is another key word there, and accounted for. Patrick Hoffman, so important to have you on the ground there over these past few days. Thank you so much for your perspective and putting it into context. Well, now my next guest says that if the Cuban army either fires on civilians or joins in the protests, it's game over for the regime. Jorge Castañeda is a former Mexican foreign minister and now a professor of Latin America and Caribbean studies in New York University's, and he's joining me from Mexico City. Thank you so much, Mr. Foreign Minister, for joining us. So let's follow up on what we just heard from Patrick, that the scene on the ground there looks quite different from what we saw Saturday, Sunday. It looks like authorities were really able to crack down on these protesters. What should we be reading into that?
Well, I think, Jenna, your correspondent is quite right. They do seem to be able to have gotten a handle on all of this in two ways. One, by arresting people who participated in the demonstrations, in the protests, and two, by shutting down the internet. It's not so much only that they can't post videos and pictures, and that they can't, the correspondents and others cannot learn what's going on, but that Cubans cannot communicate with each other. The protesters cannot communicate with each other by WhatsApp or SMS or whatever to know what's going on in another neighborhood of Havana, in another suburb of Havana, or in other cities in Cuba. And that, of course, weakens enormously any protest movement. the minute there's no communication among the protesters, there's a tendency to die down. So it does look like for now, the authorities probably with a very heavy-handed repression, but without putting the army into the streets and without any deaths reported so far, seem to have gotten a handle on all of this for now, as I say.
So you say for now, this caught a lot of people by surprise. We haven't seen these kind of protests in decades. I want to actually play for you what one of these protesters said in the sense of not having the same fear that they once had before. This is a Havana resident named Mikhail.
It is becoming impossible to live here. I do not know if it, unrest, could happen again. I don't know, because right now Havana is militarized. The person you least suspect is a policeman. I don't know, but Cubans are losing their fear. They are losing their fear. I don't know. Maybe this unrest will continue.
So is Mikhail an outlier here, or does he speak for many residents of Cuba? And what does that say about the future of the revolution and the regime there?
I think, Viana, the causes, the underlying causes are still there and will continue to be there, particularly through the month of August, which is traditionally when many of these protests have taken place, because it's one of the hottest months, if not the hottest month, in Cuba and in Havana. And because of power shortages, et cetera, life becomes particularly difficult in July and August for city residents. There is no food available. There are no medicines available. There are not enough vaccines available. There is no electric power for elevators. There's no gasoline for transportation. Literally, the country is at a standstill. So these causes are still there. Part of them come from the economic reforms of eliminating the several currencies they had at the very beginning of the year. There is a sort of hyperinflation going on in Cuba today, in addition to the scarcities. Scarcity is that there's nothing available, but hyperinflation is that it costs so much, whatever is available, that you can't pay for it. So all of these causes are still there, and they're going to continue for many weeks or months. The issue is whether the people of Havana and other towns are going to come back into the streets, let's say on the weekend or the day after tomorrow or 2 weeks from now, or whether it was just a one-hit wonder, let's put it in those terms, on Sunday. It's very difficult to say. The regime is very sensitive to these things, although obviously Fidel Castro is not around like he was in 1994 when he went to the Malecón and basically stood down a crowd of protesters himself. Raúl Castro can't do that, and Díaz-Canel sort of did it in San Antonio de los Baños on Sunday, but it's not the same thing. The regime is very sensitive to this, and they know they have to stop this from happening again. We have no way of knowing whether they can. So then the issue becomes what the international community does, or nothing, with regard to these protests.
Well, so what should the international community, namely the United States, be doing in terms of policy? We know that President Obama had tried a detente of sorts with relations with Cuba and lifting of some of the tight sanctions there. They were reimposed by President Trump, and they still exist and are in place under the Biden administration. This is not an administration that had prioritized Cuba, but you see what happens in the world, whether it be Israel, whether it be Haiti, and now Cuba. And this is a front and center issue for this administration. President Biden tweeted that he stands with the people of Cuba as they bravely assert their fundamental and universal rights, and as they all call for freedom and relief from the tragic grip of the pandemic and from the decades of repression and economic suffering. Other politicians in his party and in the Republican Party are also pushing for this administration to do more. What is the right approach from the Biden administration right now?
Well, the first point would be, Viana, that this is a bit of a vindication of President Obama's policy from 2015 and 16, in the sense that the availability of the internet, the possibility of Cubans having cell phones, communicating among each other, et cetera, has led to these protests. This is only possible because of Obama's normalization of relations back then. Trump having clamped down through sanctions obviously made life miserable for everyday Cubans, for Cubans on the street, but didn't seem to affect the regime a whole lot. What the Biden administration has to look at today is whether, one, it wants to loosen the sanctions, which essentially is what it had insinuated during the campaign, that Biden would go back to where Obama was 5 years ago. But conversely, he also has to decide if he wants to support the people of Cuba more actively. For example, by trying to set up internet communications by satellite, which the government, the Cuban government, cannot shut down. These are tough decisions because they can be viewed as very hostile by the government.
And that is what people like Senator Marco Rubio are suggesting that the president do as well. And obviously, domestic politics plays a huge role in President Biden's decision going forward. Before we move to the region, I do want to ask you one more question on the revolution and the meeting of the revolution, right? All of these decades later, generationally, what it means and how significant it is for Cubans. I mean, you wrote the book, you wrote one of the most prominent books and biographies on Che Guevara and the meaning of the revolution, obviously the leader there of it in Cuba. What is your sense personally on the term revolution and what it means for the Cuban people right now?
Well, I think it means a tragedy in the sense because it's been now 62 years, and basically they are still going through extraordinarily difficult conditions of everyday life: food, medicine, transportation, electric power, clothing. Absolutely everything is scarce, expensive, unavailable, or only available under extraordinary means. They've been through 62 years of difficulties, and what do they have to show for it now? Very, very little. Their vaunted health system has collapsed in the face of the pandemic and the absence of vaccinations. Their education system is in tatters because the schools are shut down. The revolution really has ended in a tragedy for the Cuban people. For many years, there were ups and downs. There were a lot of defeats, a lot of setbacks, but there were also important achievements. Today, there are no achievements. Mm. There's no Soviet Union left to support them. Right. There's no Venezuela left to support them. It's a tragedy. It's not a revolution.
Let me ask you briefly, final moments here on Mexico, because you have been very critical of President Obrador there and his policies and how the United States, not just President Biden, but the presidents before him, his predecessors, have approached the relationship with Mexico, focusing, as you say, too much on border and migration issues and not enough on policies within the Mexican economy and government that you say have a larger overall impact on the United States. Can you explain that for us briefly?
Well, both Presidents Trump and Biden, the first one nastily, President Biden nicely, have basically carried out the same policy. As long as the Mexican government, as President López Obrador, keeps the Central Americans away from the U.S. border, either by stopping them at the southern border of Mexico or at Mexico's northern border, President Biden doesn't seem to care a whole lot what goes on in Mexico. What goes on in terms of American interests, what goes on in terms of Mexican democracy, Mexican respect for human rights, etc. He seems to be looking only at the immigration issue. The problem, of course, is that there are far more Mexicans leaving Mexico and entering the United States without papers than there are Central Americans. And the problem, of course, is that if the Mexican economy tanks, as it has been tanking now for 2 years, there will be many more Mexicans going to the United States, and there will be more drug trafficking, and there will be more erratic macroeconomic policies by President López Obrador. So I think President Biden should focus more on what's going on inside Mexico, what's going on in the economy, in society, in human rights, in democracy issues. And also, by the way, Viana, speaking with President López Obrador about Cuba. Is there no way that Mexico and the United States cannot cooperate and find common ground to deal with this Cuban crisis? I mean, these are two countries which are close to each other and close to Cuba in different ways and have been close to Cuba in different ways for 60 years now. Is there really nothing that presidents have to say to each other?
It really stood out to me that you compare Obrador and his approach to the migrant crisis to Erdogan of Turkey and how he approached the crisis from Syria a few years ago. We'll have to leave it there. We appreciate your time so much. Thank you so much for joining us, Foreign Minister.
Thank you, Viana.
And just a note that we have reached out to the Cuban government to invite an official on the show and have yet to hear back. Coming up after the break, live from Budapest, we're joined by the Hungarian foreign minister to discuss a controversial new law that critics say targets the LGBTQ community. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We turn now to Hungary, which is facing widespread backlash after passing what many describe as an anti-LGBTQ law. It bans the depiction of homosexuality to anyone under the age of 18. It's seen by critics as yet another assault on Hungary's LGBTQ community by right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. The government claims that the law is actually intended to protect children from pedophilia, but it sparked outspoken condemnation from leaders across the European bloc.
This law puts homosexuality and gender reassignment on a par with pornography. This law uses the protection of children, to which we are all committed, as an excuse to severely discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation. This law is disgraceful.
And joining me now to discuss this is Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó. Mr. Foreign Minister, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. So let's begin with this law, because it claims to be combating pedophilia and pornography. And I'm just curious, has there been a recent uptick in reported pedophilia crimes in the country?
Thank you very much, first of all, for giving me the chance to express our opinion. As well, I've seen many opposition politicians already joining that global fake news campaign which has been going on against my country regarding this law. So this law definitely has two parts. One part is about protecting children from pedophilia. This part of the law basically modifies the penal code and puts very, very serious consequences to crimes committed against children on the field of pedophilia. It sets a very high limit for the length of imprisonment. And on the other hand, it establishes a database, a registration system, where we will register those who have committed such kind of crimes. And this database is going to be accessible for in cases when one takes a job where he or she gets in touch directly with children. And in case of being involved in this database, such jobs cannot be definitely occupied.
But to go back to my question quickly, has there an increase in cases over the past few years? Because typically what leads to a law is a significant problem, and I'm just wondering if that's what you've seen within the country.
Well, unfortunately, there have always been such kind of crimes committed against children. I wouldn't say that we have extraordinary high numbers when it comes to European comparison, but even one crime committed against children on the field of pedophilia is too much. So
no doubt.
We wanted to attach the strictest possible consequences to such kind of crimes.
Right, and no doubt. And one crime is too many, I agree with you, but many are comparing it to a similar law that was passed in Russia in 2013 that connected it with gay propaganda. And I want to get to some of the amendments that are attached to this law, which impact the LGBT community in Hungary. But in terms of the Russian law that many view in similar light, that it is targeting the LGBTQ community and tying it in with child pornography, there was a recent report that was put out by The Economist that showed some of the countries around the world, in particular Europe, where children are in fact the safest from child pornography and pedophilia. The United Kingdom tops the list. Russia is close to the bottom. So this law has been in place in Russia in terms of protecting children for now almost 8 years, and the results don't seem to be indicating what Russia says they were set out for. And I'm wondering if you are looking at this in the same light, because Russia doesn't seem to be a great role model in this perspective.
I'm not quite sure that you know that I'm representing the government of Hungary, right?
No, I am. I'm just saying that there are those who suggest that this law looks very strikingly similar to the law passed in Russia, specifically since there are amendments in which, let me just read this to you, that says school sexual education should not be aimed at changing gender or promoting homosexuality. It prohibits those under the age of 18 from promoting and displaying homosexuality and gender reassignment. It even prohibits broadcasters on TV from showing viewers under the age of 18 any images depicting sexuality for self-serving purposes. People are wondering whether Harry Potter can be shown on air before a certain hour. What does this have to do with child pornography?
Look, to be honest, I have no clue about the Russian law. And to be honest, I don't even care about that. I'm not representing that country and not representing that government. Now we have spent like 2 minutes with analyzing the Russian law in this regard, but I don't care.
They're very similar. I'm surprised that you don't know anything about it.
Russia or not. Okay. But I don't know anything about that. What I know about is the following. As being a member of parliament, we have passed this law into the two parts. The second part of the law modifies some of the already existing laws in Hungary, including the law on families, the law on protection of children, the law on media. And this law speaks very clearly that to conduct the education of the children under 18 regarding sexual orientation is the exclusive right of the parents. This is what this law says. This law doesn't say anything about adults. It doesn't say anything about sexual orientation of anybody above the age of 18. In Hungary, according to constitution, any kind of discrimination, including discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, is prohibited. This law only says that it is the parents who have the right to conduct the education of their children under the 18 regarding sexual orientation. And this law says that no pornographic content, no content on explicit sexuality, on promotion of changing gender, on promotion of homosexuality should be accessible to children. That's what it says. And I think it's the obligation, not only the right, but it's the obligation of the state to protect the children from such kind of contents. That's what the law says. And you know what? I'm pretty certain that that it's the job of the parents to conduct the education of their children regarding sexual orientation and not some NGOs.
The law, as you know, does not exist in a vacuum. In 2013, your country banned same-sex marriage. Late last year, your government banned same-sex couples from adopting children. So you can see where some may draw a line and a connection between, you know, this pedophilia law and the idea that Hungary is not a welcome place for LGBTQ members.
Okay, let me repeat. According to the Hungarian constitution, any kind of discrimination, including the discrimination on sexual orientation, is prohibited. No one has to be afraid in Hungary just because of his or her sexual orientation. No one can be discriminated on this basis. Yes, our constitution says that marriage can be made between man and woman, like many other constitutions of many other EU member states and many other countries all around the world. And yes, our constitution says that the father is a man and the mother is a woman. This is how our constitution is speaking about family. But this is national competence. And on this basis, no nation can be considered worse than any other nation on earth. And I have to tell you one more thing. It's fake news that pedophilia and homosexuality would be confused in our law. You will not find a sentence where these two phenomena would be confused. One part of the law speaks about very, very serious consequences of pedophilia, and the other part of the law speaks about the protection of the children regarding the education of their sexual orientation. Two totally different and isolated parts of the law. Nothing is being confused.
Were there certain child psychologists and experts that you approached or whose research you are citing leading to this law in the sense that you are so concerned about the impact of seeing homosexual couples together or any content about homosexuality for those under 18?
Well, I'm pretty sure about the following, that me as a father, as a parent, know my own child much better than any NGO or any other institution. That's why it's much better for my children that I conduct their education regarding sexual orientation and not an NGO who does not know anything about my child, and I don't know who they are financed by and what's their aim and what's their goal. Now, the law does not prohibit, of course, education related to sexual culture or sexual orientation or sexual development addressed to minors. But such kind of education must be conducted by authorized and professional staff. What we would like to avoid is that LGBTIQ activists go to kindergarten or go to schools and try to promote any kind of behavior or orientation to our children. It must be only the parents. That's our very firm and very strict opinion in this regard. And I don't think that on this basis we should be considered as worse than any other countries or any other legislators.
There's a teacher whose quote I wanted to read to you, a teacher in Budapest who teaches English. And she said that she will not be adhering to this law. She says the law excludes young people at a developmentally very fragile time in their lives and says, quote, this law questions the core of the individual's personality. You should support them. You should show them that they are acceptable and they are lovable the way they are and that this is what is being taken away. I know she's not the only teacher and educator in the country who feels that way.
Well, I don't agree with that opinion, to be honest. I respect that opinion, but I don't agree with that. And I hope that once you will quote the opinion of those teachers who deeply agree with this law, because by only quoting one side, puts forward a portraying of the situation as if there were only teachers who think that way. There are teachers thinking the other way around. But I would like to tell you that education...
I was just going to say that there is a poll conducted recently, in fact, in May of 2021, that showed 56% of Hungarians say that same-sex couples should have the same rights to adopt children as heterosexual couples do. So in the sense of speaking for the people, the majority have spoken, and it seems to differ from what this law is putting in place.
I don't know this poll, to be honest, and I don't know on what basis it has been made.
It's an Ipsos poll that we use a lot here.
On what basis? I don't know about that. I know one thing is that our constitution speaks very clearly about this issue, and the constitution was adopted by the Hungarian parliament by a two-thirds majority. And I'm not sure whether you know that this law, which is now being under very heavy attack, has not only been voted in favor by the ruling party in the parliament. This has been voted in favor by the leading opposition party as well. The leading opposition party, which is part of the United Opposition. I've seen that you have made reports with representatives of the United Opposition here in Hungary who judged us and criticized us for this law. I regret that you have not asked them how it is possible that the leading opposition party, which is part of the United Opposition, has voted in favor of this law as well. So portraying this situation as if this was only the opinion of the ruling parties in Hungary is simply not true and not fair.
So a final question, and we'll have to leave it there, Mr. Foreign Minister. This law has nothing to do with upcoming elections next year.
The law has nothing to do with the next year election. That was a question, right? Because I didn't get it
yes,
properly.
Yes.
This was the question.
Question.
No, it doesn't have anything to do. No, it has nothing to do with next year's election. It has to be done with the protection of the Hungarian children. Because once again, the Hungarian children must be protected from any LGBTI activists and NGOs in the schools and in the kindergartens. And it must only be the parents who conduct the education regarding sexual orientation of the kids in Hungary.
Mr. Foreign Minister, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
And still to come tonight, we take a closer look at the Taliban's reign of terror in Afghanistan. That's after the break. Welcome back. We turn now to Afghanistan, where tens of thousands have been displaced amid a surge in fighting in recent months. This follows President Biden's announcement of the withdrawal of U.S. troops by September 11th. The Taliban have made substantial gains in north, northwest, and southern Afghanistan in recent weeks. New video shows evidence of the brutal tactics used against Afghan commandos in this conflict. CNN's Anna Korn has the story from Kabul. And just a warning, her report contains some graphic images.
After over 2 hours of heavy fighting, all ammunition spent, Afghan commandos walk out with hands in the air. Surrender, commando, surrender, yells a Taliban member. But the rules of war don't exist on this battlefield. Seconds later, more than a dozen members of the elite special forces have been executed. The Red Cross confirmed the bodies of 22 commandos were retrieved. A villager pleads with the Taliban to stop shooting, asking, "How are you Pashtun and you're killing Afghans?" CNN has spoken to five eyewitnesses to this massacre, which occurred last month in Jalalabad, a district of Faryab province in northern Afghanistan. All confirm these events took place. The commandos called for air and ground support, but none came, says this local resident. Then they surrendered, but the Taliban just shot them. Among the dead, 32-year-old commando Sohrab Azimi, the son of a retired Afghan general. This born leader did his military training in the United States and was due to marry his American fiancée next month. His father said Sohrab tried to call in air support during the attack, but it never came. Anyone would be angry if that happened to their son, he tells me. Why didn't they support the operation, and why did someone tell the Taliban they were coming? Ever since the U.S. announced its withdrawal, an emboldened Taliban has launched offensives across the country. The militants have gone to great lengths to show they're accepting the surrender of Afghan troops. But that PR effort is contradicted by the commando execution. A week before the massacre, this video was taken of Afghan special forces in the same district attempting a clearing operation. When that mission proved unsuccessful, Sohrab's unit was called in. The Taliban said when foreigners leave, they will stop fighting and make peace. How long will they continue killing our brothers in this country? Eyewitnesses say they did not understand the language spoken by the militants. Evidence the fighters weren't local or that some may have come from outside Afghanistan. And just last week, the Red Cross says it collected at least 2 dozen more bodies of Afghan commandos from Faryab, the result of new fighting.
U.S. President Biden says he believes in the capability of the Afghan forces despite the mass casualties. But when U.S.-trained soldiers like the commandos are dying in such high numbers, many people in this traumatized country are questioning if the military can defeat the Taliban on its own.
These young Afghan warriors, stretched thin and dying at an alarming rate, are now the last line of national defence. Without US troops' support or intelligence, they alone are fighting for this country's survival. Anna Corrin, CNN, Kabul.
Our thanks to Anna for that. Such harrowing scenes there. And when we come back, does America have a drinking problem? I'll ask Kate Julian from The Atlantic. Plus, soccer fans show their support for Marcus Rashford. That's coming up. Welcome back. While the cloud of COVID is still hanging over many of us, some are getting a taste of freedom for the first time in months, meeting friends, eating in restaurants, and yes, drinking. In her latest piece for The Atlantic, journalist Kate Julian looked back on the origins of America's drinking culture and asked the questions most of us want answers to. How much is too much? And is alcohol really that bad for me? Kate Julian joins me now from Washington. You have written quite the talker, Kate. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Before we address those issues, can you talk about how drinking habits have changed over the past year and a half during the pandemic?
So what we know is that sort of almost by definition, much of the drinking that's been going on has been drinking at home, right? With people you live with or even alone. As bars and restaurants were closed, as parties went away, that type of drinking, that sort of social drinking fell away with them. And many of us at home either stopped drinking if we were purely social drinkers, or if we were sort of glass of wine, you know, at home type drinkers, we might have increased that drinking. So research shows that we were drinking more frequently, like more nights a week, more nights a month, and also that we were drinking more by volume.
And that's Americans or around the world? Because it was interesting to see that there was actually a drop in consumption that you saw in Europe versus the United States. Obviously, many European countries and most of the U.S. had been under lockdown. It appears, though, that Americans decided to drink more at home and alone as opposed to out socially at bars and restaurants, which is what Europeans tend to do and obviously couldn't at the time.
Exactly. It's really fascinating, the sort of divergence between America and Europe. There was a study in Addiction Journal last month in which researchers looked at a really big group of Europeans, 32,000 or so, and found that of the 21 countries that they looked at, alcohol use was down in all but two. And those two, the UK and Ireland, it was more or less flat. It hadn't had a statistically significant change. And that's really striking for the reason you say. It suggests there's something about American drinking culture that met up with the pandemic and sort of moved in a different direction than it did in Europe. And I think that that really does go back to this question of why Americans are more comfortable drinking at home, why Americans have a long history of doing that, and what some of the sort of unexpected downsides of that may be. We haven't really focused that much on this question of why we drink. And that really is sort of the heart of the matter here when we think about the differences between fun drinking, social drinking, and solitary drinking, which some emerging research suggests may actually not make us feel that much better.
Solitary drinking, as opposed to in groups with friends, with colleagues at bars and restaurants. What's so fascinating about this piece is that you don't just go back a few years prior to the pandemic. You go back to basically the founding of this country and the significance that alcohol has played, even, you know, starting literally with Plymouth Rock. Can you give us a detail on that and U.S. history in particular with alcohol?
So this was just really stunning to me, this anecdote that you alluded to, that the Pilgrims actually landed at Plymouth Rock rather than their intended destination, which had been the Hudson River, because the ship was running low on beer. The sailors freaked out at the low quantities and thought that they were not going to be able to get back home to England with the supplies that remained. Now, back then, most people drank beer instead of water. They believed it was healthier and that water might be contaminated. Nonetheless, the extent to which the Pilgrims that first winter in Massachusetts, when they didn't have beer, complained bitterly about this in their diaries is really something. What's sort of interesting as you go on through American history from there is the extent to which we have a really conflicted relationship with alcohol. Unlike other countries, we have this kind of hot, cold, love, hate, black and white relationship with the stuff. We tend to love it and we tend to hate it, sometimes one after the other, sometimes in rapid succession. One of the things I found most fascinating as I dug into the history is the history of the early 19th century. It was a time of really rapid social, technological, economic change, kind of, you might say, like the moment that we're living in now, just in terms of the pure speed of change. And Americans back then were drinking a just unfathomable amount of alcohol. about three times what we drink today, if you can believe that. Mm. People were drinking breakfast, lunch, and dinner. One historian I read said that the average American was rarely in a state that you would call sober.
Wow. Well, it does tend to be lumped in as a vice, right? It's sort of, you know, people talk about smoking and drinking in one sentence, and it does lead to this really complicated relationship with humans and alcohol. If it's so bad for you, then why have we been drinking for so many years? There are study after study appears that come out by the week about what is actually good for you, what's heart healthy, what's not. Can you break down for us once and for all, is alcohol maybe, you know, when it's not consumed every single day or breakfast, lunch, and dinner, is it good for you? What is the appropriate amount?
So for some people who have issues with alcohol abuse, like, it may never be good for you. For the rest of us, the answer turns out to be really complicated. One of the reasons I set out to write this piece is that American drinking had been rising for about two decades before the pandemic, even in a time when we were becoming more aware of some of the health risks of alcohol, the fact that it may predispose you to certain types of cancer, for example. When I started to dig into it, though, I found these really curious findings suggesting that actually light to moderate drinkers in a bunch of different studies in a bunch of different countries appear to be happier. And more socially connected than people who don't drink at all. And I thought that that was really curious, given especially that we know that happiness and social connectedness are themselves really connected to our physical health. They have a really dramatic impact on longevity. Loneliness has been compared to smoking 15 cigarettes today, and in terms of its effect on longevity. And so I thought, if we're not accounting for that, if we're not accounting for the social effects that alcohol may have, we may be missing a big part of this picture. And as I started to do further reporting, I learned that there is an emerging body of academic research led largely by Robin Dunbar, who's an anthropologist at Oxford University in the UK, trying to understand what the social benefits of alcohol may be. And they tell a fascinating story that suggests that alcohol may have actually really helped the founding of human civilization, that it may have been part of the agricultural revolution. It may have been something that helped to disinhibit us, to sort of socially lubricate us enough to sort of settle down. Warring groups of hunter-gatherers might have actually found alcohol to be something to come together around.
Yeah, wheat maybe wasn't just meant for bread, right? You end your piece with this. For those of us who have emerged from our caves feeling as if we've regressed into weird and awkward ways, a standing drinks night with friends might not be the worst idea to come out of 2021. Have you started living up to those words? Is that something you've personally experienced as well, coming out of your cave?
I'm working on it. You know, I've been doing some regular get-togethers with friends, with drinks, mostly outside, and it is really striking to me how much more fun it is to have a glass of wine or two in that context than it is at home. I found during the pandemic, as I mentioned earlier, that I was more reflexively pouring that nightly glass of wine, but I often wasn't enjoying it. The drinks with friends are really joyful. They leave us feeling, you know, just as if we had a chance to relax and enjoy each other's company. And I think that, yes, in this moment of awkwardness, they do sort of help us, you know, with the after effects of this period of isolation.
And as you've responsibly mentioned and noted, drinking is not for everyone. There are people who definitely have problems and suffer from health complications from drinking. But for those that can have a drink, I guess this is welcome news. Thank you so much, Kate Julian. We loved your piece.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally, the people of Manchester have come out in solidarity with soccer player Marcus Rashford after a mural of the England star was defaced in his own hometown. Fans affixed messages of support onto Rashford's mural, labeling him a hero and thanking him for his campaign to feed hungry school children. This was, of course, in the wake of the center forward missing a penalty at the Euro 2020 final and part of a torrent of racist abuse directed at England's black players. Rashford said, "The show of solidarity had me on the verge of tears." And having apologized for the penalty miss, stated that I will never apologize for who I am and where I come from. I highly recommend that everyone go and read Rashford's full post online. It only further highlights what a true gentleman he is. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online and on our podcast and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.